Welcome to Industry Misinterpretations, episode 125, with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This week, we talked to Julian Fitzell about Seaside 2.9, where it is, where it's going, and what the big changes are that everybody should be looking forward to in the next release. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group of Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. Well, this is James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Mike Lucas Smith, our lead on the Web Velocity project.
Hi.
And I've also got Julian Fitzell, who works on the Seaside project. We're here mostly to talk about 2.9, but we'll also do a little bit on the history of Seaside. So why don't you tell us just how you got started with Seaside and how far back your history with the project goes?
Right. Well, I go right back to the beginning. Avi and I were... We were finishing up university, and I guess Avi was working on the Iowa framework in Ruby, and we started doing some consulting together, and ended up working on sort of an online box office ticket sales application for the theater department at the university. And you know, I'm not even exactly sure how Avi got turned on to Squeak in the first place, but he was into that at the time and sort of wanted to try working with Iowa, some of the concepts that he'd been doing there in Squeak. So we decided to take that project as a excuse to do that. So we basically developed, this would have been the kind of the end of 2001, I think. We developed this online box office tool and at the same time developed the Seaside framework, the initial release, which would have been 0.9. And that we announced on the Squeak list beginning of 2002. So that was kind of the first release. And that at the time was pretty similar to Iowa. So it was just taking a lot of the stuff that had come out of there, which itself was heavily inspired by the WebObjects framework from Apple and from Next. And then we've been basically working on it ever since then through various revisions.
And that all predates Ruby on Rails, because Iowa, the work you were doing in Ruby, there wasn't a pre-existing web framework that had really hit the market that people were interested in, right?
Correct, yeah. There was nothing that I recall anyway in Ruby particularly. And there was quite a bit of interest from the Ruby community in Iowa. I mean, Iowa itself was probably nothing more than a prototype, really. But there was quite a bit of interest in it there. And then very quickly, as I say, Avi kind of moved onto Smalltalk. One of the later releases of Seaside actually got ported back to Ruby by someone else. I think that was one of the first 2.1 or 2.0, 2.2, something like that. It's called Borges.
Oh, okay. Has that gone anywhere? Because I remember hearing about that.
Well, you know, I don't know for sure. The site is still there, and I do look at it occasionally. I think there's still work going on it, but I don't know how extensively it's used. And I think there's some more recent stuff that's come out that's maybe less literally a port, but has been inspired by some of the ideas.
Okay. So basically, your history with Seaside is more or less the history of Seaside, since, as you said, you go all the way back. So how have things changed over time? I mean, you know, the big thing that people talked about when Seaside first really hit consciousness in the Smalltalk community was continuations and the fact that you could hit the back button and things just worked. And now in 2.9, partial continuations and the ability to use Seaside without continuations at all seems to be one of the big features.
Yep, that's true. I mean, when it started, continuations was the whole thing. And I mean, I don't know. It's still cool. It's cool to be able to write a task or a callback that calls out to a a page to get information. But more and more people have wanted to use Seaside, not just for applications, also for something that, you know, you'd probably consider more of a site than an application. And those tend to use that feature much less. And we used to use continuations quite a bit more, so it was used for other things. And so some of that we've now replaced with exception handling and so on. Seems to work fine. I mean, basically because we were using continuations anyway, there was at least three places. I mean, I think even Seaside 2.8 still has three places where continuations are used. We may even have had more originally. I don't remember. I mean, it used to be following the continuation flow used to be pretty tricky. and we've now basically got rid of the use of continuations for everything except, that interruption of flow. So it's now in a new package called flow. And basically if you're not doing call and answer, you're probably not using continuations. So at this point we've sort of refactored that so that it's an add-on package. And if you don't need to use call or you don't need that functionality, you can just not load the package. And that makes it much easier for some of the platforms that don't easily support continuations.
Now, which platforms are those? I mean, I know that certainly Squeak doesn't have problems, and VisualWorks, of course, doesn't have problems. Other than VisualAge, are there any small talks that don't handle continuations? I mean, I'm not asking that to slam VisualAge. I honestly just don't know the answer to the question.
I think VisualAge is the one that I'm aware of. Gemstone is implementing. I guess they had some support for it. They didn't have support for partial continuations, but they're adding it.
No, you just brought up partial continuations. You just did a blog post on continuations, partial continuations, and not using continuations at all, which is really interesting. I was hoping you could explain it.
yeah, I could try. as in, what is a partial continuation compared to a full continuation?
Yeah, why is that different to a full continuation? Yeah.
So a full continuation basically is you're just saving a copy of the execution stack. So whether that's, you know, a chain of context or a stack itself, you're saving every method context and all the local variables and so on right back to the bottom of the frame, the bottom of the stack. And a partial continuation is basically just a subset of that. So you're basically going to give a start point and an end point, and you capture just those. And the reason that we want to use that in particular, and you can sort of implement those, you can essentially implement a nearly semantically equivalent version of that using full continuations, which it turns out is sort of what we were doing, but didn't even realize it. But we basically have, when you're running Seaside, the majority of the Seaside code that is running is dealing just specifically with the current request that's coming in. So there's a whole bunch of code that's, you know, looking up the session ID, pulling up the correct session, looking up the right page, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that only applies to this request. Once you've returned a response, you don't need to, you're never going to use that code again. You don't want to save those method contexts.
Right.
So what we want is to capture basically just the frames that make up the callback that we're running. And that turns out to be, in most cases, you know, just a few method contexts, because it's basically from the point where we start executing the callback, the user does a call, but we need to be able to resume that callback later, but it's in a new request. So all of that code that was dealing with handling the request, you know, that's gone and done. When it's resumed, that's all in a new that stuff's all new, and we only want to resume the parts that we're dealing with the callback.
Yeah, I was looking forward to that. In Seaside 2.8, we added a web debugger for web velocity so that you can debug your code in the web browser and edit and resume sort of thing. But when you hit resume, we have to perform some serious magic, because you actually want to resume the original process, but you want it to answer the new request, and you want to make the debugger process not answer the request.
Yeah.
So you have to do this interesting juggle where you swap continuations around with the original process, and it was very interesting.
I mean, it actually still is interesting, unfortunately. I'm sort of beating my head against the wall on that at the moment. It works fine. The debugger works fine. Like, we have the walkback exception handler, which doesn't actually debug in the browser, but gives you the option of debugging or proceeding, and so on. And It works fine right now if there's an error during callback, during a callback or during a task. But if you get an error while rendering, it doesn't work so well. And the problem is basically that all of this rendering code is referring to a specific response object. And so how do you deal with the fact that, you know, you're coming in now halfway through having rendered a response, all this code's holding onto the old object, it's going to the wrong stream, it's going to the wrong socket, and so on. So we're sort of talking about how to fix that. I'm sort of the opinion at the moment that if you get an error during rendering, the rendering phase is supposed to be, can't think of the word, it's not supposed to make any changes, right? So in theory, you can just resubmit the request with a URL parameter that basically says, when you hit an error, debug. And presumably you will hit an error, and then the debugger actually pops up in the image. But unfortunately, it still is kind of tricky. I mean, even the question of, you know, when you're debugging, you know, are you debugging? You sort of almost don't want the request that is controlling the debugger. It's almost not even the same session, you know what I mean? It's the semantics of what should happen there get pretty weird.
Yeah, actually, I push in a new session, and I just recently had an interesting bug where if you were using session cookies, it would replace the existing session with the debug session. And given that it was session cookies, the session would be hijacked.
Right.
So a new session cookie would be pushed out to the client instead of keeping the old one.
Yep.
And now that component that you were trying to go to is forever going to go to the debugger and say, oh, the process is terminated.
Right.
So that was a fun bug along those lines as well. Yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated area of, web development in general. And you say that things aren't meant to change during the render phase, but that's generally, you know, as soon as you make a hard and fast rule like that, that's where people start having problems.
Yeah.
We just had a person had a problem for exactly that reason. They were doing a database query inside the children method, which they shouldn't have been. So, of course, instead of getting an error that they can debug, they get an internal error because it's trying to follow the children to do the actions lookup to, you know, to do anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, these things happen because, as soon as you put that rule in, oh, if you're doing something like that in this area or phase of the program, you're not going to be able to debug it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure enough, that's exactly what they go and do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can reassure Michael that you, Julian, that for once, Michael's not making fun of my code.
I wonder if that's something where, you know, you could facilitate that with some kind of AJAX debugger that's sending requests somewhere. But I'm not even sure that the Squeak debugger, anyway, it's not very consistent about what process it's running the debugged code in and so on. I don't know. It gets really complicated, and the solution we had works, and at the moment it's not quite working, and we could probably get it working again, but I'm not convinced it's the optimal solution so far. And as I say, the question for me is I'm not always even sure what the right semantics are.
You must have a whiteboard somewhere with lots of squiggly lines pointing to this and that.
Well, I have lots of pieces of paper with squiggly lines pointing to this and that anyway.
Well, one of the interesting things to me is that 2.8 was focused to some extent, as I recall, on reducing the memory consumption for each session.
Yeah.
And it sounds like with the advent of partial continuations for most of Seaside, shouldn't that also go down in 2.9?
We certainly hope so. We've done a number of things that we expect will reduce memory consumption and hopefully improve speed. We haven't actually done benchmarking yet, so I'd be premature to say that it is. We've done other things that slowed it down and made it take up more, but we're optimistic that for sure that'll go down. I mean, we're definitely talking about now storing, for every continuation that we store, you're probably storing, you know, two or three or four contexts versus, I think I counted on I ran the counter app and counted, and I think in 2.8 we had 16 or 17 contexts or something. So, I mean, how much of a difference you're going to see is going to depend on how much other state you have that you're backtracking. If you're backtracking a lot of state, the contexts themselves aren't going to make up a huge portion of your memory consumption. But if you're not backtracking a lot of state, you should see a big difference on that. And again, if you're not using call, of course, you're not storing those continuations anyway.
What other interesting effect that I've seen from, I'm not sure really it's continuations, but yeah, it probably is if you're debugging an action, and the action's a block, the method that contains the block is not on the stack. So if you decide you want to change the code, you can't rewind that method to re-enter that block. You have to rewind at some other method in the stack. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if that's the same thing I was seeing. There is some weirdness around that. I'm pretty sure
Squeak would be the same.
And maybe this is the same thing. I mean, the issue that I've definitely been acutely aware of recently is if you're using a task. How is it now? No, you're probably right. It probably is the callback. There's something or other where when you change the method and recompile it, the context is still referring to the old compiled method in the continuation. I think that's what it is. The continuation has saved the context, which is referring to a compiled method. And so when you recompile the method, it doesn't change the version that's stored in that saved context.
Huh?
So the next time you run it, it restores the values in the context, which is the old compiled method. And that's kind of ugly.
Yeah, that's a different one, but that's just as bad.
And again, like, I don't know. I don't really know. I mean, it just depends how far you want to go in making these things work. They just get ugly.
That would be one of those, but I just fixed that bug problem.
Yeah, exactly. there's a few gotchas around that. I mean, I guess that's part of the reason people use that less and less. we've added, so all the methods that we had before, like inform and show and all those things that did calls before, now have two versions, one that'll be included in the on the components all the time, which is takes an extra parameter. It's basically continuation passing style. So you would say inform, what do we call it? Inform show, inform answer, or inform, I can't remember what it's called, but you basically pass in a block, and when the dialogue answers, then that block gets run. So we've rewritten all the sort of admin tools and so on to use that style rather than using a continuation, and that means that all of our internal tools work without having that flow package loaded. So usually if you're not doing something too complex, you can fairly easily rework things to do that and avoid the continuations altogether.
One thing we discovered in my previous job, we started out using Seaside, and then we were forced to use Visual Age by our management because they weren't willing to buy a Visual Works license. So we built our own framework that was inspired by Seaside. Later, we ported that to Visual Works. So we went full circle there. But as we went more and more down the Ajax path, we discovered we didn't need the continuations because the Ajax basically allowed us to not need it, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And we used the JavaScript hacks to modify the current browser URL so that the browser would have forward and backward buttons.
Yeah.
The programmer could therefore choose when a back button existed, and at that point you say, okay, we're on a new page now, take a snapshot of our state. And that was when we would take our continuation. So you would never take it any other time except when the programmer explicitly said, this is a point that I can return to. And they could also assign a URL to it, and they could encode the way that you would treat that URL as, okay, if you come into this URL, that means read this object from the database. And then you could do things like take the object's name and map that to the URL space. So that was really interesting. But what we discovered was that the Seaside pattern of the canvas, where you say, you know, div, span, style, all that kind of stuff, that was so useful that, and we were writing more and more JavaScript to create elements on the client side instead of creating Smalltalk code to create elements, that we really wanted the Seaside pattern in the JavaScript.
Okay.
That was interesting. We also discovered that what we produced in... there's a rule in Seaside that you can't modify an element that you've closed off, despite the fact that almost everything you do in Seaside, you have to kind of cache up the whole result before sending it back to the client anyway. So we created XML trees, but they weren't normal XML trees. What they were was a change set on the existing XML tree. So you have a page that you're always modifying with the Ajax, and the request comes in from some action. It modifies the XML tree, which produced a bunch of change objects, and the change objects would send back a minimal change set to the client, which would run that in JavaScript to modify the page.
Okay.
So we were answering requests in microsecond time, not millisecond time, and most of our code involved give me some sort of state from the client, like give me a whole bunch of JSON to describe these objects. So it was really interesting. This was just an evolution of where Seaside was at the time, and I can see these sorts of techniques becoming applicable again in the future, but at the moment, Seaside still has this rule of it's a one pass to produce the tree, and there's no real object artifacts. We found that when we had the object artifacts, that there was no need to separate components from tags as well, because they were essentially the same thing. So there were some interesting developments that we made there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, all that stuff disappeared with the company when the company disappeared.
Right.
And we were desperately trying to open source it at the time, but our management wasn't interested.
Yeah, there's definitely some confusion about the difference between tags and components and when you would use one, when you use the other, I don't know. I don't even know that I know the exact answer for that. Usually have a feeling for it, but I mean, basically the tags end up essentially representing, you know, literally the HTML tags. Nothing more complex than that. One thing I've done in 2.9 is to one of the main goals of 2.9 was to package it up into pieces, and in doing that, I sort of realized that the lines between these different levels had been kind of muddied over the few years that I had been. Probably neither Avi nor I were as closely involved, and of course that's a problem with leaving a project with no documentation. so it had kind of, you know, evolved organically, and little tendrils were growing across the layers. So we tried to split those up, and one of the things I've been doing to try to make things easier to understand and easier to document is to make sure that we have an abstract. Well, it's not even always an abstract, but a superclass of all of the package classes in the core. So components and decorations are both presenters, and presenter is a subclass of painter, which is in the core. And painters do very little. I mean, basically a painter's job, which is at a high level what a component is doing, its job is to take a renderer of some sort, usually a canvas, and write onto a document using it. So I'm hoping by having that class there that people will realize that they can create things that aren't components when you don't need, if you don't need all the call and the answer and the state and all that kind of stuff, if you just want something that's rendering, you know, it's just a widget, it's just, you create it, you render, you throw it away, you can create a subclass of a painter to do that. And that's something where people previously would have tended to use tags, which I guess there's nothing even wrong. This is where I say, I don't even know that I'm 100% clear on what the rules should be on why you should use a tag in one place and not another, but trying to sort of set up those higher level classes so that you can see, well, okay, this is just a specific case of something that is doing something more generic.
That was one thing I really like about Seaside is how pluggable it is, how configurable it is, and that's really appreciative. I mean, we've got three different JavaScript frameworks plugged into it, and we've got all these different Smalltalk's using it, and yeah, it's very nice like that. If it doesn't quite fit your needs, you may have to subclass five different classes to do it in some sort of chain of configuration. But you can change the way Seaside handles just about anything.
Yeah, and that facilitating that is really one of my primary goals. I don't know if that's everyone's goal, but that's one of my primary goals for this version. Is I think there's only a small subset of people who really realize the amount of flexibility that you have there. So really trying to, as I say, make the layers clear, make the roles of each of the parts clear, make it more obvious the different things that you can subclass, and, you know, hopefully try to get some documentation, which is why I'm writing these blog posts to sort of highlight some of the things that people maybe are less familiar with.
Well, that kind of touches on one of the things that I recall was one of the primary goals for 2.9, at least going back when it was first announced, was to make it easier to maintain ports of Seaside between the various Smalltalk dialects. So, you know, is what you were just talking about touches on that. Can maybe you can expand on what kinds of things have been happening? You know, is it just basically a broad refactoring so that the platform-specific pieces are easier to deal with?
Yeah. Portability is another major goal for sure. Basically, what we've done is we've split the main code up into, I don't know, probably about, well, half a dozen main packages. So there's a core package, a canvas package, a component package. What am I missing? There's the flow package now that does the continuation stuff. A session package. So there's those sort of, I think there's about six kind of main chunks. And then each of those have tests, which are in a separate package. So you should be able to load, in theory, you should be able to load just the core and just the core tests. And if you don't need any other stuff, you just want to build off of the core, which is basically going to provide, classes that model the HTTP protocol, classes that deal with dispatching requests, that kind of stuff. If you want to write basically your own framework, you could load just the core package and the core tests and go from there. So those are split up, and then any of those packages may have platform-specific packages that go with them. So we'll have a core, and then we'll have a squeak core. And the tests, so the core tests will depend on having both of those loaded. So theoretically, somebody porting, for example, core to a new platform, you would load the generic core package, you'd load the core tests, you'd run them, and stuff that's failing, you would then implement in your platform-specific core package. And once all the tests are passing, you're good, in theory. I think we're up to about 1,000 unit tests at the moment across all of the Seaside packages. So, we'll see, because Gemstone and VA and GNU are all actively doing it. So, if they come out with something that works on the other end, then we'll know our unit tests are okay.
Yeah, we're actually getting closer to porting 2.9 officially, and I'm very much looking forward to that. That'll be in VisualWorks 7.7, because we're coming to a close for Web Velocity's 1.0 beta, and when you're kind of stabilizing something, you don't suddenly jump to a new version of VisualWorks and a new version of Seaside. You have to stick with what you've got.
Yeah.
And, So our timing's been pretty bad with the whole porting scene for 2.9.
Well, we certainly would like to have you guys, giving pushback when we break things. So we'll be happy to see you porting it whenever you're ready.
Yeah, I've been ready for a while, but so soon, very shortly, I hope very shortly, we'll be able to start working on that and get some good feedback to you. I don't imagine it'll be that big a deal, because a lot of the hard lessons were learnt in 2.6 by Michelle Benny, and 2.7 was very simple. 2.8 had a few gotchas that were fixed along the way. Most of the gotchas were actually caused by the various 2.8 patches, which was interesting.
Right.
Yeah, so 2.9 is, in theory, very, very not that different from 2.8. So I think porting 2.9... should be fairly straightforward.
Well, I mean, 2.9 is interesting because at some level you can look at it two ways. If you look at it at a high level, it's very, very similar to 2.8. We sort of expect that if all you did was subclass session and implement components, your code will probably, it probably won't just work, but those sort of the public interfaces of those haven't changed that much, and most of what we've removed or moved, we've marked as deprecated, so it'll still work. You just get you'll get a notification when you have the toolbar turned on. So from that level, things haven't changed much at all. But if you dig in, there's almost nothing we haven't touched. So, but it's all been most of it has been refinements to the existing architecture, with only a few exceptions. So it will look very, very familiar to anybody who's used Seaside 2.8, but hopefully it will make more sense.
So what's next? Is it 2.10 or is it 3.0?
I don't know, to be determined. there was discussion on the list about that a while ago. People don't like it once you hit 9, but I don't know. This ties into our release date for 2.9 too. There just isn't a lot of, nobody's clamoring for anything particular, there's nobody screaming about anything that they want that isn't there or whatever. People are sort of generally,
I think that people have been screaming the most to me about have actually been widgets.
Yes.
A really good grid widget is one that they've been asking for a while. And there are bits of those things in various add-ons, but
Yeah.
And, you know, Seaside has this message of and also widgets, right? So I guess that's an area that... But it doesn't really need to evolve, you know, in the core of Seaside.
No, exactly. I think it's highly unlikely that you'll see that coming out of any of the existing core developers anytime soon, just because there's enough work dealing with the other parts, and that part is something that is so easily done by somebody else. And everybody asks for that, but no one ever seems to actually do it. I don't know. I don't really know why, but...
Well, seeing as how I used to be a product manager, I could say welcome to my former life, because that's exactly the kind of question I'm more used to, just for visual work. So yeah, any large scale framework or product, you get those kinds of questions all the time. Actually, I wanted to jump back just a second. You mentioned the release schedule for 2.9 in passing. Do you have kind of a baseline estimate for when you think that'll be out? I mean, never mind when 2.10 or 3.0 or whatever is going to be scheduled. Do you have a time for when 2.9 should be getting close to release?
Well, it's funny because you just posted my my talk from ESUG, and I was listening to it again. Somebody asked me that question back then, and I said, "Oh, should be out soon." I think. I think we're starting to feel like we're about ready to get a beta soon. There may even be an alpha, a third alpha coming out this weekend or next weekend. And I think we're starting to feel like we've done most of the major changes we want to do. And, you know, there's always a next release, so we can't keep going forever. So I think I'm not actually going to give you a date, but I think we're heading soon to a beta.
So you think you're about ready to have people start pounding on it and tell you what things are not completely working?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think we're getting close. I mean, a lot of the issues at the moment are just having now split everything up into packages so that there's something like 50 packages altogether. The tools for managing those and loading those in order are starting to show signs of being pushed to their limits. So that's something we're also going to have to look at, and that's part of the reason we're really holding off having too many people get on it until we're fairly sure that we're not going to be moving things between packages and renaming packages and all of that kind of stuff, because at the moment, trying to figure out what you need to, like, just starting from scratch and loading the code into an image is fairly straightforward. We've got a builder site that generates either a load script or a Monticello dependency thing, whatever that's called. And loading it in is fairly straightforward. But once you've waited 10 days and you want to update to the latest code and somebody's moved classes around and trying to figure out what order to load the packages in and stuff, it's just a nightmare. So,
absolutely, yeah. Well, actually, I got criticized for when I ported Seaside 2.8, I put it all in one package because it is all in one package and all the dependencies were cross-dependent. And it was split up by categories. So now that there is actually separate packages with clear dependencies between the packages, I'll be able to port it that way, and people will stop yelling at me.
Oh no, they'll find something else to yell at you for, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. Fear. You know, that's the life we live.
Yeah, it's really a thing of beauty to see those. I mean, when we started, we split up into these packages, and there were just circular dependencies all over the place. We had a tool for generating a graph showing the dependencies and highlighting the circular ones in red, and it was kind of a game of going through and trying to break all those red links. And
you probably should have left that diagram around, because you'd probably be able to discern the plot line behind Lost if you looked at it.
Probably. Well, we still have the diagrams without the red lines anyway. I'm still using that on a daily basis because you know, as you move stuff around and refactor it, you have to keep checking whether you've introduced new circular dependencies. Usually John O'Keefe gets on us pretty quick about that, because he sounds like in VA they're actually unable to load them with circular dependencies, so usually within a day or two he's screaming that we've broken it. But it's a thing of beauty to see that dependency thing turn into a beautiful little tree of all focusing down on the core. I was just saying, the other thing we did there was introducing, so below the core package we also have a platform package. And that adds some really low-level stuff. We've added a subclass of object, WA object, and subclasses of error, notification, and those kind of things, so that we can guarantee that we have initialization behavior that's the same on all the platforms and that kind of thing. And I guess there was already a platform support class in 2.8, I think.
Yes.
So that's been, you know, we've extended that and added some more stuff and more unit tests for that, and And that, so between that and the platform-specific versions of these classes, that's basically the portability mechanism now.
So portability then, everybody moving to Monticello 2 was a bit premature.
Yeah, that one doesn't seem to be quite ready yet. I was actually in Vancouver in when was that, in November, and did some work with Colin and Dale from Gemstone, trying to get some stuff pushed through on Monticello 2. And that was trying to change the way a few things worked in a way that I thought was going to work better for Seaside. And then Colin was away for Christmas, so that's kind of been stalled. But as soon as someone finds some time to get back to that, I think that those pieces that I was working on are kind of the last remaining pieces before we would feel that at least in theory it was something we could work with. And we definitely are hopeful that Monticello 2 will help ease some of these package woes, because it can just be so slow loading things with Monticello 1 sometimes when you're loading a lot of packages. And the other thing we really want to get is, I can't think of that word either. Just to be able to load all the packages at once, because otherwise you run into these issues.
Atomic loading, exactly.
Otherwise you run into these issues where you move a class from one package to another package, and if you don't load, well, it almost doesn't, you almost can't load either one first, because one moves it and the other one removes it, and then you have obsolete super classes, and we've spent a lot of time using the recompile all button in Monticello, basically.
Sounds like some of the stuff that we've had going on in store for a long time.
No doubt. we're not using Monticello 2 yet, but as soon as we're able to, we'll definitely be looking at that, because I think it is going to ease some of our pain.
Okay, well, that's thanks for coming on, Julian. I really appreciate getting the look at what's going on in Seaside 2.9 and what kinds of changes we can look forward to. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Not a problem.
Yes, and just thank you very much. This time we haven't actually lost the podcast. Our dog didn't eat our homework.
Well, we hope anyway.
No, I can see the bars recording, and actually your audio and Michael's. I always do a backup record of the other people just in case something bad happens. So I've definitely got all that. And unless Audacity crashes on me in the next 2 minutes, I'm cool on my end. But it's always a possibility.
Yeah, you never know. You don't want to jinx yourself.
Yeah. Actually, Michael, why don't you ask your classic questions?
Yep, classic questions. So did you have fun? Did you enjoy yourself? Would you do this sort of thing again?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And do you listen to the podcast?
Often, not always, but often.
Okay, that's better than usual. Will you be listening to this episode? Just, you know, even though you've just recorded it.
Well, that's a good question. My girlfriend will probably listen to it, so maybe I'll hear it in the background. Yeah, no, I probably will.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, thanks again, Julian.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. I was recently tracing down a problem in client code when I saw something strange going on. An operation that should have raised an exception and stopped actually worked and continued running. As it turns out, somebody had implemented a method that caused the problem to be quietly ignored. In this case, a Smalltalk developer years ago had a problem where a variable contained nil, and was reporting a does not understand to a do colon method. To solve the problem, the programmer implemented do colon for undefined object to just return nil. This solution just sweeps the problem under the carpet. It also hides similar problems in the future. Now we can't easily fix this problem properly because we don't know how many other places rely on this assumption and would break if we fixed it. It's always best to take the high road and solve the problem properly. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Perth, Australia. Robert Waters is looking for a Smalltalk software engineer. Any exposure to financial development is considered a plus. Quoting from the job posting, minimum 2 years commercial development experience with Smalltalk, C, C++, or Java. End quote. Based on this, it appears that you don't have to have Smalltalk experience for this position, but if you have experience with other object-oriented languages and are willing to learn Smalltalk, they would be interested in talking with you. Grand Prairie, near Dallas, Texas. Multiple companies are looking for a software engineer who has experience with VisualWorks 5 or above, GUI development and relational database experience, SQL, Oracle, and DLL interfacing. Experience creating custom widgets is considered a plus. There are various employment options available for this contract, and the offering companies are putting up a pay range from $35 to $61.25 per hour. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the industry misinterpretation of the podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.